Idly hey.
Welcome to another episode of The Brett Allen Show.
Prepare to be astonished.
A pop culture podcast. Join Brett weekly as he interviews your favorite celebrities from film, television,
I'm back in business, baby!
Comedy, and much more.
Inconceivable!
Plus, you never know who will stop by.
Dude, we are so gonna party!
Now, here is your host, Brett Allen.
It's another episode of The Brett Allen Show, a pop culture podcast and video cast where we talk to your favorite actors and comedians from film, television, of course, comedy, music, and more. And today we have a very special guest. I am so excited about this that we've been working on this for a while. We are chatting with comedian and author now, Roastmaster, all the above. You've done a lot. Jimmy Carr, we're going to talk about his book, Before and Laughter, a life-changing book. Jimmy, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here today.
Well, it's an honor and a privilege for you to have me on the show, I feel sure. if it's a show about favorite actors and comedians, I'm not sure whether your audience will have me in their top 10, but maybe after this, maybe I'll change a few minds, win some hearts.
Yes.
Very much like the US military in Iraq. That's my campaign here.
Yeah.
Shock and awe. Shock and awe is what I'm going for.
Yes. Well, I have to say that I've been a fan for a very long time, going all the way back to the game shows and all the things that you've done. But when I found out that you had written this book, being a father myself, I was very excited because when I talk to comedians and comedians who have kids, it's just a different kind of vibe because, I mean, you do what you do, obviously, but you're also a parent. And then when you write a book, it's even better because it's very inspiring. This book essentially is great because it takes us on a journey of your life a little bit and kind of gives us some insight to sort of how you got started, but also writing this book as a memoir, so to speak, for your son. And I don't know if it's you say this kind of jokingly that before you're too old and he's too old to get it, but really, that's kind of the genesis of this book is sort of just passing on some wisdom and sort of a life note, I guess you could say, about kind of what you've done. And it's just it's a great book.
The problem with wisdom is it's earnest. And the people listening to this podcast, people that are fans of comedy and pop culture, don't really go for earnest. You know, there's a whole swathe of our society that goes, look, I'd love to read Eckhart Tolle, but he doesn't know any dick jokes. So I need someone else to kind of, I'm kind of taking the whole of life and filtering it through the charcoal of comedy so that it becomes in some way palatable. That's the pitch for the book. That's the idea. And it's fun. I mean, I think being a father has changed me in lots of ways, but also I'm still the same guy. I tell very edgy jokes. That's the kind of sense of humor that I have. I think your sense of humor is like your sexual preference or your taste in food. Some people like the rough stuff and they like it spicy and they like, you know, edgy comedy. And some people like mild comedy and they like bland beige food and they like the missionary position. Who are we to judge on any of these things? It's given to you. I like edgy comedy, but I also, you know, you can, I think, be very sincere about life without being terribly serious about it. And it's nice to make that kind of distinction and write something that I think, I mean, it's had a lovely reaction so far. It's like in the UK, I have to explain to people on this podcast, I'm like a big deal in the UK. Like I can shift some books in the UK. So it's got a lovely reaction from people of like going, oh, well, like I got something out of it. And there was quite a lot of, it's like I'm standing on the shoulders of giants as well. It's like it's littered with my favorite quotes. And I kind of like that quotes, almost like jokes, like everything else gets burnt away other than the essential thing. So like one-liners, I'm sure that, you know, it starts as always a longer thing, and then you kind of cut away everything that doesn't you don't need for that laugh.
Yeah, I kind of definitely get that vibe from the book. So this was a project that you started mid-post lockdown when you started writing this.
Every touring comedian got the call from the agent, 4 weeks into lockdown, sort of drumming their fingers on the table and saying, yeah, I noticed income's fallen off. Either a podcast or a book. And I thought, I was actually asked to write a piece for, there was a book that was, we have a national health service here. I don't want to go on about it, but, you know, we have free healthcare. So maybe I don't know. I guess maybe we're better than you, and you should you should rethink that whole Boston Tea Party thing. That said, they were doing a fundraiser for our free National Health Service, and we were all asked to write a piece. It's my friend Adam Kay, who wrote this wonderful book called This Is Going to Hurt, about his experiences as being a doctor. And then we all wrote pieces about the NHS, and I wrote a piece about my mother dying in hospital. And a publisher read it and thought, that's pretty good. That's nice. You could turn your hand to that. You could be a writer. I mean, the only reason I never wanted to be a writer is it's much harder than being a stand-up comedian. Because, like, stand-up's one of the great jobs. It's got, like, there's inherent wisdom in stand-up. Like, all stand-ups become kind of masters of failure. I've written more jokes that don't work than any of your listeners. You know, because, and you become very okay with failure. You become okay with, like, trying stuff and going, yeah, that didn't work. Oh, that didn't work. That didn't work. And then eventually you fail so many times, you can't help but succeed. And obviously, you know, no one gets to see the working out. That's a great kind of lesson in life. And I thought, well, it's interesting to use stand-up as, you know, an analogy throughout the book for how you're like, you know, what do comedians do better than regular people? Well, they're better at listening, he said, as he talked at his interviewer, better at listening, better at watching and observing, brilliant at pattern recognition. I mean, really, the nature of all jokes is pattern recognition and playing with those patterns, the expectation of those patterns. But that's really all of human progress is pattern recognition. So it's an extremely important skill. You know, that kind of linguistic ability as well, the quality of your communication being the quality of your relationships. You know, with yourself and with the outside world as well. So it's got it all in there. Also, I should mention, because I haven't said anything funny in a bit, it's fucking funny. It's a fucking funny book.
It is. Yeah, it is quite hilarious. And again, being a parent, being able to relate to so many different things that you talk about, and of course, your humor. And I have to say, that's one of the things that I like, is that when you did become a father, you didn't change anything about yourself. You still are telling the same types of jokes, and people know you.
I had this thing happen. I was about maybe, it was on the day my son was born early. So, you know, it's all a bit traumatic when your son's born early. And I had to go out, he's a bit premature. So I had to go out and buy, you know, those little, what are they called? Onesies, right? The onesies, yes, for babies. So we had some of those, but they were for a full term baby, which was a little bit bigger. So on him, they dwarfed him. So he didn't fit him at all because he was tiny. So I had to go out and buy these teeny tiny baby grows, and there's a place near the hospital that sells them. So I went out and I bought, you know, the first day being a father, I'll do something useful. I'll go and I'll buy the baby grows. So I'm buying the baby grows, and I get like six of them in the premie size. And I hand them to the lady behind the counter in the store. And she said, do you want the coat hangers? I said, it's a bit late for that. Well, I've not changed. I've just had the most beautiful experience. And I'm very happy to do abortion jokes. Great. Perfect.
I'm curious what the response was of the clerk when you made that statement. Did they get it? Did they know who you were? Or were they just mortified?
I got it and laughed. Yeah. They yeah. I mean, thank God for being recognized. Otherwise, I mean, it's a weird thing, actually, in the culture that we live in at the moment. I think being a comedian is almost like it's licensed to joke. It's like you're allowed to say things that regular people now would sort of think twice about. But somehow, just being labeled a comedian, you're allowed to kind of, you know, say things that are slightly transgressive. And I mean, I think comedy lives in the space between public and private discourse. And it's never been wider than it is right now. You know, if you watch the TV news, whether you're on the left or on the right, it doesn't really reflect the conversations that I'm hearing in the real world. So, you know, people are much more questioning and much more kind of apt to sort of, you know, say, well, what's going on with that? I think they want I think people want a debate. And it strikes me that the sort of political classes and the people that are very engaged are in their entrenched and in their echo chambers and their amplifiers, even more so than echo chambers. And regular people are kind of going, well, hang on, can we hear from both sides? Can we not talk about this? And again, talking about things, it's like, humor is a great way to process stuff. You know, we talk about things that are kind of on the edge, and I sort of think it's, I think my comedy's edgy, not offensive. And the
right
decision I make is that it's progressive. I'm interested in ideas. I don't hate anyone. It's fun, and it's pushing things kind of forward rather than reactionary and saying, I want things to stay the same. You know, I've got no illusions about the past being some green and pleasant land. I think it's like everything's getting better, but it's happening very slowly. And I think you can kind of joke. Here's the great quote. You can joke about anything, but not with anyone.
Yeah, that's the thing I find fascinating about comedians and stand-ups like yourself, is that you all say the things that a lot of us are thinking. And quote-unquote cancel culture that wants to stamp out art, which is purely subjective, I think is frustrating for me, because what you're doing is you're providing an opportunity for people and other comedians to really say the things that we want to say and make it funny, just like this book. You know, there's lots of humor throughout this, a lot of the stories that you share and that sort of thing. And it sounds like you said the response has been fantastic with the book. Yeah. I know you've been doing a virtual book tour too, or will be starting one soon with it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, that thing, isn't it? The, you know, cancel culture is obviously, it's a very interesting thing to talk about, but really, you know, you know, everyone's got their, you know, the great thing about Twitter, the great thing about social media, I think people always had artists that they liked, didn't like, approved of, didn't approve of, didn't want to hear that kind of comedy, but they didn't have a voice. And now everyone's got a voice, and that has to be a good thing. The problem is that if everyone has a voice, obviously there will be people that don't like it. And how many people does it take before it's a Twitter storm? I'd say 20 is more than enough to cause a Twitter storm and a story in the wider media, and a question about should the corporation that's paid for your special, you know, be allowed to exist anymore. It seems that it's like we're trying to find our way in a new world. And it's good that people have, you know, opinions. Like, it's like, I'm not right about stuff just because I'm an edgy comic. And people that are offended by it have the right to be offended and the right to say, I don't want to watch that. But the idea of saying, I don't want anyone to be able to watch that, it seems crazy to me. It's like if you take the 1970s cancel culture kind of thing, which cancel culture used to come from the right, but it now comes from the left. It's a very interesting switch that's happened in our society over a 30-year period. All banning this filth kind of, you know, we must take, you know, adult lyrics, or, you know, not suitable for children, or R ratings came from the right. And now it all comes from the left. It's a very interesting, you know, look at cancel culture. I think it's the new book burning. And
yeah,
I think anyone that's, you know, because you're wiping someone out, you're basically saying, well, I don't want them to be able to exist anymore. You're sort of burning the book metaphorically. And I don't think anyone that burnt the Beatles records in the 60s feels great about it now. I mean, maybe there are. Maybe there are people that go, you know what, I stand by it. You know, fuck those guys. But I think most people go, oh, yeah, we didn't really react to that. We didn't have a debate.
Yeah, it's like it was something that happened in the moment. But really, like at the end of the day now, it's kind of like, why did we do this? You know, like what was the point behind it? Other than maybe perhaps just trying to create something. And that's the thing about this book is, and you call yourself edgy, which I find interesting, because even in the realm of comedy, you know, I can think of 5 or 6 comedians off the top of my head that would consider themselves to be edgy too. But I think comedy just as a whole, you have, as you said, a license to talk about things that maybe I might not have the platform to do.
You know, comedy is a long tradition, right? So before there were stand-up comedians, there was music hall performers in a thing called variety, where you've lots of different flavors in variety. You know, it's part of the thing is there has to be lots of different types of people doing this, lots of different types of acts. And then before that, there were court jesters. And before that, there were trickster gods, like Anansi and the Monkey King. And, you know, where there's always been someone sort of that can tease and that is, you know, a trickster and, it, you know, is playing around and messing. And that's very important for human culture, that we don't get too uptight and po-faced.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's very right. And the other thing that you mentioned is the fact that making a conscious choice as a comedian when you're writing jokes to say, you know, to just alienate somebody altogether. When you are writing your material outside of the book.
So, just rewind on that. So making a conscious choice to alienate.
Well, you said something to the effect of making it to where nobody wants to listen or something to that effect. When you're writing jokes, you're writing with the general mass in mind for people to respond to what you're saying, whether they agree.
Here's the thing. I I think I'm picking up on the point here. So let me get this right. So my writing process is I kind of write for me. I write stuff that I find funny. That's the first thing. That's the first hurdle it has to jump, right? So it's almost like Walt Disney had three rooms in his house. Probably four. He probably had one for anti-Semitism as well. But he basically had three rooms. And the first one was for creativity. So that's kind of writing the joke, the initial idea. You know, never refuse the muse is my go-to, right? Because it rhymes, it must be true. So if you think of something, oh, wow, that could be, that's a funny phrase at 3 a.m. If you're a comedian and you don't write that down, I have news, you're not a fucking comedian. you're an amateur. Okay, but you have to write that down. If you make a list of everything that you think might be, there's something in that. And then there's a managerial room where you take that stuff that you kind of was just the bare thought, thing in a conversation you thought, oh, that could be something. And then you try and hone that and make it as good as possible. And then only in the third room have you got a critic. And the critic critiques what you've done. Is that good? Is that bad? Now, I've outsourced my critic. I think most comics do. My critic is the audience, and the audience is a genius. Lenny Bruce said it first. The audience have had no training. They've given no thought to comedy. And they can tell me with 100% accuracy whether something is offensive or not and whether it's funny or not. And, you know, if something just gets a big reaction, that ain't a joke. I could say terrible things on stage and get a big, ooh, it has to get a laugh first and then maybe an ooh, that lovely sense of cognitive dissonance. You know, that thing where you have like two thoughts at the same time, kind of the measure of intelligence, the idea that you can go, well, I'm laughing at that because it's very funny, but there's another bit of me that always comes in slower because it's the sort of formal nurture part that goes, oh, should I laugh at that though? It's naughty.
Yeah.
And that's a lovely kind of space to work in. As far as alienating people, I mean, listen, I'm an entertainer, and you want to entertain as many people as possible. It's interesting that thing that happens where people get offended by one joke. But the format of what I do, though, you know, is very much one-liner. They're clearly jokes, feed line, punchline, laugh. So no one really gets confused with that in an opinion. I mean, you could do if you wanted to. If you had an axe to grind, or if you're a journalist that thinks, well, I need to write a story, I'll watch one of his DVDs and find something. You can, of course, you could find something. But no one's really, the audience, audiences are smart. They really are. And they get, oh, that's a joke. He means that. He doesn't mean that. They get the nuance of humor. I think comedians leak. I think that you can watch someone's hour-long special and they haven't said a fucking thing about themselves and you have a sense of who they are.
Oh, 100%. You can pick up on that really well. I know we have a time restraint on this, but I want to talk about the other side of that. When you're writing jokes
all day long, this is talking about comedy for me. It's like, I mean, listen, I don't know whether the listeners are getting anything out of this, but this kind of inside baseball chat about comedy is, I live for this. And I love that podcasts have brought this to people. This kind of, it's long form. It's conversive. It's a conversation about stuff. It's really interesting. And I feel like the reason they've done it is because it's missing from the rest of our culture.
Yeah, 100%. That's why I have so many comedians on, because of the fact it's an opportunity outside of going to watch it somewhere to talk to you and really get deep into your process and the psyche behind it. So when you're writing jokes for, like, let's say the roasts, is your approach the same for writing roast jokes versus like something that you might do for a special or something along those lines, or are they completely different?
No, it's a very similar thing. You're going to the same well, and you're sort of staying within those constraints. I think the important thing with roast jokes is it's not about the person you're writing about. That's the thing. Remember. Yeah, if you try and write a joke about someone, it's overly specific. And really, what I believe in social justice. I believe this is a Neil Brennan quote, one of my favorite comics of all time. But I believe in social justice and stereotypes. So you write to the stereotype. You write to the kind of stereotype, and then you go, well, you know, it becomes like a. So if I'm writing a joke about, I'm trying to think of her name on the last roast, the right wing commentator Ann Coulter.
If I'm
writing a joke about Ann Coulter, she can take it as personally as she wants. But really, that joke is about, okay, so that's a right-wing Trump-supporting commentator. What's the thing that's going to pop there? And then you're kind of looking for the outlandish, the worst thing you could say in that scenario. For roast jokes, there's different points awarded. It feels like with roast jokes for bravery, like how far are you willing to take this? I actually gigged with Jeff Ross was in London with Dave Chappelle a couple of weeks ago. and we did a session together where we got like, you know, that great thing he does on tour. Have you seen Jeff on tour?
Oh, yeah. He is the best. So different than most, but I love it. He's fantastic.
It's a great format, I think, him live, because it feels like the thing Jeff does is he hosts a party and you're all invited and we're all on the same level and we joke about everyone. And I like that thing about, like, you know, my only issue with offense is when it's on behalf of someone else. If someone is offended, if someone says, hey, listen, you made a joke about this and I'm in a wheelchair and I actually found that a difficult, you know, a challenging joke. I didn't like it. I'll listen to that all day long. Someone saying I'm offended on behalf of my, okay. I think it's very inclusive to joke about someone because you're sort of saying, when people say, are you punching down? I always think, well hang on, are you? To be punching down, I'd have to be looking down. Wait, are you looking down on these people? You just like someone going, oh, you're punching down on disability. You go, no, who, what? So you're looking down on those people, are you? Yeah, fuck you, man.
Yeah, I've been wanting to ask that question for a while with other comics and I just haven't gotten to it. So it's interesting. So you're writing about the situation or some, but not them specifically. It's
Well, you're trying to see the broad things of that. You're obviously with roast jokes. I mean, this is very specific to roast jokes, but you're going, what do people recognize here? It's okay. No use finding out a detail about you and going, oh, you know, his mother had, you know, grew up in Oklahoma. Oh, okay. Well, I'll do an Oklahoma gag. What? No, the audience don't have that information. What can we see? You know, people, there's often that thing about, you know, if you're a comic, you've got 2 minutes to impress the audience. You're living in a fucking dream world. You've got until you walk to the mic. They've already made up their mind. You know, people are so smart. Most of communication is nonverbal, whether that's, you know, tonal or body language or whatever, you know, so they've made up their mind. It's like that. It's the confidence thing is everything.
Yeah. When you come out on stage, we know what we're getting, what to expect. And also the other thing that I want to talk about is your crowd work, which I like. I was watching something that you had done recently and I don't know how old the special was, but there was like some Yo Mama jokes in there that you did that was just super brilliant.
I love that. I think also the thing about the Yo Mama thing, which is, I mean, it's not as cliched in the UK as it is there, but it really, it really anchors me in childhood. There's something about a Your Mum So Fat joke that makes me remember being 15 and 16 at school and teasing your friends. And the first time, like, I don't care how good the comic is. I'll put Chris Rock and Richard Pryor and Louis C.K. and fucking George Carlin up against you and your friends. And they will lose every time. Because the funniest jokes you've ever heard, the most you've ever fucking laughed, is with your friends, a little in joke. And so I think sometimes the heckle stuff speaks to that, right? Because it's like, you're taking the mick out of someone in the audience. You're taking the piss and there's a warmth to that. That is obviously, if you're a piece of AI equipment and all you can do is see the words being exchanged, you would think violent altercation, but that's what all jokes are, right? All jokes are, it's remote tickling. When you think about what tickling is, right? Tickling is like a violent act, but it's made benign by the act of laughter. It's yes. It's okay. You're saying this is not a threat. And when someone, you make a joke about someone and they laugh, they're showing status. They're demonstrating their status within the group. They're going, yeah, I can take it. And it's a fascinating area. I made a documentary for the BBC for Horizon years ago about laughter, about how laughter is about a million years older than language. It predates us even speaking. And it was the reason we were able to have bigger groups and specialize and become humans is because we were able to, we didn't have to groom literally. We could just grunt or point. And there was a shared, okay, I'm showing my teeth. It's okay. There's no threat.
Yeah. I like that analogy of tickling. I think of my 7-year-old. Sometimes it could be perceived as aggressive on his end, but we make it fun. And he goes, I get it. And the other thing about roast, or not roast, but
that's crowd... if you hold that point for 1 second, because I think it's a really important thing because it speaks to everything we're talking about today.
It does.
Actually, some kids don't like to be tickled.
Yeah.
They don't like that. Some kids love it. It's their best thing. They want to be tickled until I can't take it anymore. And some kids hate that. And you have to respect that. You have to respect, well, you know, so there's, when I talk about my audience or the audience, there's no the audience. Like the people that come and see me like that tickle. They like
yes.
that. The other people, not so much.
If I go to an Anthony Jeselnik show, I'm going because I know what's going to happen.
You're going because I was not playing in that city and, you know.
Well, come to the Bay Area and I'm there, man. I mean,
Anthony so much. I mean, it's that thing where you go, the thing about this kind of chat is I want to list for you, like, who are the people you love? Like, Anthony's amazing. I love Neil Brennan. His new Broadway show. I haven't seen the show. I've just heard the audio that he sent me, but it's unbelievable. It's so good. I love Jim Jefferies. There's so many great, you know who I love at the moment? Beth Stelling.
She's amazing.
Like next level, just terrific. Michelle Wolf. There seems to be like, there's a crop of just brilliant comics just kind of around the place. It's so inspiring. It's like so great when you see good shows and you kind of go, oh my God, I've got to work harder. I really have.
Yeah. It's interesting that there could be the position where it could be intimidating perhaps maybe to some comedians who are at a certain level versus another, but to be able to have that camaraderie, that's the other thing I admire about comedians.
Well, is that
there's
not
an overall sense of camaraderie.
You know Alan Havey?
Yes.
He's an incredible comedian and a dear friend of mine. He was in like Mad Men and stuff. He's a tidy little actor, actually, Alan Havey. But he said this great thing to me years ago. He said, we were eating chicken wings in the Comedy Cellar and drinking whiskey. And he went, we're out for ourselves, but we're in it together.
Yes.
And I just thought, oh, that's the whole fucking thing right there. Like, no one is in competition. Even if you're doing something ostensibly similar to someone else, you go, well, there's plenty of room for all of us. And actually, them doing better, it just makes the pie bigger. I want every comedian to take the roof off. Because then people go, well, comedy, I'll go and see some comedy. Great.
Yeah, I think it's inspiring for everybody because it motivates to go out. One last question about the crowd work. Go ahead.
The thing, though, is that it's that difference between envy and jealousy.
Yes.
You know, in show business, there's a lot of jealousy, which is I don't want him to have that. You don't necessarily even want the show that he got given. You're not even an actor. You don't want that partner film, but you don't want them to have it. That's very negative. And envy tells you what you want. Envy can be quite useful in life because it tells you what you want. And that's the most fundamental of questions. What do you want? So if someone gets a special or they're playing Carnegie Hall and you go, I want to do that. You go, well, okay, great. You go after that then. You know what you want now. Go after it. I always think like, if someone does well in comedy and their success is not my success, that isn't a friend. That's a frenemy. And you need to kind of deal with that because otherwise I think this business kind of rips you up because it's so kind of, you're so apt to become jealous of other people's success.
Yeah, I could see that very much so. So kind of circling back to the book here, you were in corporate America and doing these types of things. Where was the moment where you knew that comedy and this sort of thing was something that you wanted to sort of pursue?
Listeners. The whole book is kind of about this. I was about 25. I was working for Shell Oil, which at the time wasn't even the bad guys. At the time, this was pre-Greta Thunberg. We thought we were doing a fine job. I was working in marketing for them, and I was very dissatisfied. I wasn't depressed, but I was sad. And I felt like I wanted to do something else, anything else. I wanted a life less ordinary. So leaving to become a comedian wasn't about being like a internationally famous on TV, playing 40 countries, touring the world, all of the plaudits, Netflix specials, all of that stuff. It's not about any of that. It was yo-ho-ho, a pirate's life for me. I don't care about any of that stuff. I just want to pursue what I think I'm best at, what I think my gift is. And I think, you know, there's two great adventures in life. And the first one is finding your purpose, finding out what's your edge. What's the thing you do better than anything else? Not better than anyone else, but better than anything else you do, right? You don't have to be the best in the world. You just have to be better than yourself last year. And then that's the first adventure. And the second one is pursuing that. You know, I've had a very privileged life that I got to do both.
I mean, that whole adage of...
I felt like that was like signing off. I felt like that's definitely, I'm going to die, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we could end there. I think that's just super important. This is a great book. Again, the title is Before and Laughter, a life-changing book. Again, a memoir to your son. And I think everybody should read this because it's just a great book, especially if you're a parent and really helping sort of navigate through your life and sort of understand some things. One last question, Jimmy. It kind of out of all these things that you've done, whether it's in comedy or the specials or any of those things, best advice that you were ever given in the trajectory of your career that stuck with you and that sustained you throughout this entire journey that you've been a part of?
Well, okay. I mean, the whole book, every self-help book is the same thing. Every self-help book says the same thing. And sometimes they spend 500 pages saying it. I'll give you it in two words. Prioritize later. That's it. Hard choices now, easy life later. That's it. That's the best. Writing now, it's a pain. Writing a book, oh my God, the ball ache of writing a book. Having written a book, fucking amazing. Having written that joke and doing it on stage, wow. What a thrill. But doing the work is sometimes a bit, so find something that you love doing, you'll never work again. And always prioritize later. You can be rich and you can be healthy, but you need to exercise and you need to save and all of these things. There is such a thing as a time machine, but time just moves at this speed in this direction. But you're going to meet yourself in the future. It's just not like Star Trek. You'll be there. And I think that thing of going, prioritize later.
I love it. Jimmy, thank you for joining me today on the podcast. I appreciate it.
It's an absolute pleasure. I suppose that the last question, the other thing that I didn't say there was there's two myths in our society, certainly when it comes to comedy. And one of the myths is genius. That guy's a genius. He's such a genius. It's easy for him because he's a genius. And the other myth is he worked so hard. Oh my God, he worked so hard. Of course it happened for him. He worked so hard. It's always bullshit. It's always a mix of the two. Find out what you're best at, work very hard at that, add time, that's your luck. You're buying lottery tickets, and every time you work harder at what you're best at and get more specialist in it, you get luckier. Be lucky, my friend. We should do this again. That was an absolute pleasure talking to you. I really enjoyed that.
That brings today's show to a close.
Goodly do.
Thanks for stopping by. If you enjoyed the episode, feel free to share it with a friend and subscribe. It's absolutely free. The views and opinions of the guests do not necessarily reflect those of the host.
Autobots, roll out.
Go home.